Energy and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Welcome. We're sorry for the delay this morning. We had another meeting in our room until just a few minutes ago. Today we're going to do an overview of the PCA budget, and we're hoping we can get through the whole thing in this committee. We're going to do our best.
She was one of them.
So, welcome to the committee.
She said it was cold out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Commissioner Rodis.
I'm Deputy Commissioner of the MPCA. My name is Leo Rodis, and with me is Lyle Mueller, who's the Finance Manager for PCA. And thank you for the opportunity to come here to talk about our budget, and along with the Chair, we hope to be done today. So with that in mind, just to kind of get us started, what I'm going to do is actually skip the first six slides because it's information that we already presented in the overview a few weeks ago. And I'll jump right to slide number 7, which really gets us into the meat of the budget. The other thing, you'll notice that we've provided many slides with lots of information, and we did that to provide the committee with some reference material that you can use to look at outside of the committee time. So I don't intend to spend equal amounts of time on each of the slides, so I'll probably skip a slide here or there. And maybe just focus on the highlights for some programmatic areas. If at any time you feel like you'd like to delve into a slide in more detail, I'd be happy to do that, of course. But I think that might get us through within 2 hours or so. So to start off on slide number 7, which is the governor's recommended budget for the upcoming biennium, as you can see, is a pie chart that describes where the sources of funding for the MPCA's budget are. So what I'd like to talk about just briefly is the Environmental Fund, which is the largest source of funding for the agency at 40%, the Remediation Fund, which is the second largest source of funding and receives much of its funding from the Environmental Fund, and I'll talk about how that works in a minute. There's also an appropriation from the General Fund at 15%, and this includes the Governor's recommendation for the Clean Water Legacy Act, as well as another General Fund initiative to support our activities in permitting ethanol and mining facilities. And then there's also a federal funds component at 13%. Now, for the Environmental Fund, the receipts to that fund are as follows. We receive solid waste tax in the amount of $95.3 million, which is a little over half of the Environmental Fund. There's a motor vehicle title transfer fee, which comes back to us this biennium, and that's at a total of $23.5 million. We also receive fees from folks who get air quality permits, generate hazardous waste, or also get stormwater and water quality permits, and that's at $43 million. Those are the main sources of funding to the Environmental Fund. The Remediation Fund, which is a total of $72.3 million, that receives the large part of the Remediation Fund is a transfer in from the Environmental Fund of $56.9 million. The way the Remediation and Environmental Funds are structured is as follows. There are funds that go into the Environmental Fund, and every biennium, a portion of the Environmental Fund is moved into the Remediation Fund based upon what we believe are the dollars necessary to do remediation projects over the course of the biennium. And at this point in time, we have about 40 projects that range from $100,000 all the way up to several million dollars. And these remediation projects are things like cleaning up old landfills, cleaning up old Superfund sites, and things of that nature. So, again, about $50 million moves from the Environmental Fund into the Remediation Fund. If it turns out in the course of the biennium that there's a need for additional dollars in the Remediation Fund, and there is a balance in the Environmental Fund, the agency does have the ability to move funds from the Environmental Fund into the Remediation Fund, although we are required to notify the chairs of the Environmental Finance Committees in the House and the Senate before we do that.
Excuse me. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So when I'm looking at the pie chart, there's 39% in the Environmental Fund.
Yes.
$50 million, more or less, goes into the 23% for the remediation?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, that figure is actually after the transfer has taken place.
This is afterwards.
Yes. So the receipts to the Environmental Fund actually total $173.8 million. And the 124.6 in the pie chart is after the transfer has taken place.
Thank you.
Other receipts and revenues to the Remediation Fund are the Petro Fund, which is from the Department of Commerce, and that's in the amount of $17.2 million. And then we have some dedicated and non-dedicated fees, such as the Dry Cleaners Fund, and some revenues that we receive from investment income, things of that nature. The last category, the miscellaneous special revenue account, the largest portion of this at $17 million is the agency's indirect costs. And then a smaller amount is cost reimbursements for seminar and workshop fees and things like that. On the next slide, this gives you a sense as to what the trends are for the agency's budget over the last 10 years. Now, if you recall, the agency combined with the OEA, the Office of Environmental Assistance, 2 years ago. And so these budget figures actually include the old OEA's budget as well as the PCA's budget, so you can make a good comparison across the years. And as you can see in this next upcoming biennium, we anticipate an increase in the budget. Over 60% of the funding is from the Environmental and Remediation Funds, which is higher than it has been historically. Once upon a time, we received quite a bit more of the general fund than we do today. The governor's recommended budget does anticipate a 15% share of our funding from the general fund. Again, a lot of this is because of the Clean Water Legacy Act initiative that we'll be proposing. Now, just to give you a little bit of perspective on how we spend the money by program, and I'm just going to spend a short minute on this. Our budget is structured according to water quality, land quality, air quality, and a couple of smaller other categories. And this gives you an idea of where we spend our dollars by program, so it gives you a sense of our priorities. 30% of our budget is spent on water quality programs. 29% goes to land programs. A lot of this is because remediation projects, while they don't require a lot of staff, they're very, very expensive projects because these cleanups typically are multi-million-dollar projects. The air quality program is about 7%. It's percentage-wise, it's a smaller percentage of our overall agency funding, but it's the place of a lot of important work, especially as it relates to the governor's priorities on renewable energy. And then multimedia, which is essentially the area where we do a lot of things that cross-cut air, water, and land, and don't really fit neatly in any one particular area, which is the same thing for environmental assistance. Environmental assistance is actually where most of the work from the old OEA now resides. Now, to touch on the MPCA's priorities in the next slide, we talked about this at the overview a few weeks ago, but they really fall into two major areas. One is making sure that we are able to continue to provide the core environmental services that citizens expect of us, and that's permitting, compliance, and enforcement. And this is largely focused on industrial facilities as well as municipalities. And then monitoring and assessment. This is people who go out in the field and assess the quality of our water and air. Cleanup and emergency response and environmental assistance. Again, those are the activities that came to us from the OEA. So that's really the first big major area, and that's sort of the foundation of what the agency does. The second priority, which relates to some of the first priorities, is impaired waters. And this is really embodied in the Clean Water Legacy Act and has been a major focus for us for at least the last 3 to 4 years and will continue to be into the future. Now, the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about the pressures on our priorities, which is important to understand as it relates to the initiatives that I'll be talking about in a little bit. One is that we've seen extensive litigation against the agency over the last 2 to 3 years, particularly related to impaired waters. There is one case pending before the state Supreme Court right now, the Maple Lake Annandale case, which I know many members of the committee are familiar with, that has significantly affected the way we do permitting, has put a number of permits on hold. We have about 60 facilities that are waiting for permits from the agency that we cannot act upon until the Supreme Court acts or makes their decision. We also had a case within the last year or so that was brought against the agency challenging our issuance of a municipal stormwater permit, that it wasn't rigorous enough and that we didn't provide enough opportunity for public comment on all the permits that we have to issue to municipalities. We lost that case. As a result, there's quite a bit of additional work that we had not anticipated when we first issued that permit. We're also seeing tremendous growth in a couple of industries in particular. In ethanol, we have 23 projects that are either on the books or in the planning stages. Anytime an ethanol plant wants to go into the state, they have to get environmental reviews and permits from the agency, which requires quite a bit of work. Same thing for mining projects. We have 8 projects in the pipeline. Those are from Mesaba Energy to Mesabi Nugget, Polymet, Minnesota Steel recently had an environmental impact statement go on public notice where the DNR is the RGU. Again, these are pretty complicated, considerable projects that take quite a bit of effort from the agency. And then there are new and unanticipated pollution issues. The EPA annually reviews about 1,700 new compounds that are generated by industry across the country. Whenever they issue a new standard or issue new guidance related to these new compounds, that can and often does result in changes in our requirements and are things that we can't always anticipate until they hit us. Now I'll jump into the program, the major program areas of the PCA's budget, and I'll start off with the land program. The way I'm going to structure the presentation, by the way, is it follows from the agency's strategic plan, which for each major programmatic area, for air and water and land and administrative services, we have very, very specific vision statements and goals and objectives that we're targeting through our programmatic work. So what I'll do with each segment, and first example is land, is I'll talk about the vision that we have for the land programs, and then I'll just give you a couple of key goals that give you an idea of what we're focusing on in particular. And then as we move through the programs, it'll just kind of help you understand where we're anticipating moving in the next 2 years. But our vision for land is that Minnesota's land supports desired uses. And that's really key because when we see facilities, especially facilities with historic contamination, whether it's an old landfill or if it's a site contaminated with old waste from the 3M Corporation, the PFC issue you've been hearing a lot about, it's critical for us to be able to marshal our resources so that we can actually restore the land that people are using to their most and highest productive uses. The way we look at our land programs is in three different areas. We look at prevention as a key element, so we have programs in place that act to reduce or prevent pollution in the first place. We also have management programs, which strive to make sure that the waste that are generated today is managed appropriately and isn't disposed in a way that's going to cause future problems, and also cleaning up the waste that are historic and in many cases quite significant. Now, what you see here is a very, very high-level organizational chart for the agency. The reason we wanted to provide you with this is that compared to like the DNR, where the budget is actually structured according to their organization, ours is not. We have an organization that's it's called a matrix organization, where our major programmatic areas cut across organizational boundaries. We made this decision about 10 years ago so that we could really address some of these more complicated multimedia issues in a more effective way. So you don't see the air quality program just in one place. You don't see the land program in just one place, et cetera. So as we move through the program areas, I'm going to point you just to where this happens in the agency. And I have all the agency's division directors with us here today in the event that you have questions about some of these program activities. The land work happens in three different areas. Our industrial division is where we do all of the hazardous waste regulation. And the municipal division is where we do some of the hazardous waste regulation, but also the solid waste regulation of landfills, municipal solid waste facilities. Remediation is really the bulk of the land work, and it's where we do what it says. We do remediation of old cleanup sites that have contamination. Briefly, land programs, to give you a figure, a sense of how this looks in a figure, 77% of the program is funded through the remediation fund, and smaller portions in the environmental, federal, and miscellaneous special revenue accounts. In the remediation fund, the largest slice of this is the closed landfill program, which is $34 million a year. Petroleum remediation program is $17 million, and Superfund is $22 million. In the environmental fund, roughly $9 million is the solid waste administration account, and what this basically means is this funds the activities that we do to regulate solid waste in the state, and $5 million is hazardous waste. Now, as I move through the land program elements, this next slide that talks about components and outcomes will just give you a flavor for how I'm going to move through the presentation. I'm going to talk first about the cleanup programs, and then I'll talk about the management programs, and then the prevention programs. Of course, our priority in terms of trying to manage waste is really the reverse of that, is that we really aim to prevent pollution in the first place. And when it gets to a point where we have contamination that is above acceptable levels, we of course do cleanup. But it's always cheaper to do prevention in the first place. Before I jump into the programmatic areas within land, I want to talk a little bit about PFCs, because this has been in the news very recently. There were a number of public meetings that took place in the East Metropolitan area last week. And I wanted to just give you a sense as to where things are today compared to where they may have been a month or two ago. Recently, within the last few months, we have detected a new compound called PFBA. And to give you some context of what we're dealing with in the East Metro is there is a whole class of compounds manufactured by the 3M Corporation going back to the middle of last century that were disposed of in landfills. There are four in particular that we're especially concerned about in the East Metropolitan area. But these compounds were deposited in a way that basically are problematic today. They've leaked out into the groundwater, and they're causing the communities in the surrounding areas quite a bit of concern. We have been working on some of these other compounds now for a few years since 2000, or a couple years since 2005. The state of the science is continually changing, and now we have an ability to detect this compound PFBA, which we didn't have a year ago, and we're finding levels of concern. So that's really sort of the major issue that people have been focusing on at the public meetings last week and focus of the stories in the major newspapers recently. The actions that we're taking are according to the normal protocols that we take in the remediation program, which is as soon as we discover that there is contamination that we're concerned about, we begin work with the regulated parties, the responsible parties, to make sure that they understand what's going on with the contamination, what the source is, and to provide us with their proposals for how they're going to clean up the contamination. In the case of PFCs and 3M, it's more complicated than most of the standard remediation projects because we're finding that this compound is in lots of places that you wouldn't typically expect from a typical landfill site. We're finding it in fish tissue in the Mississippi River. We're finding it in groundwater. We're finding it in the soils. And we're finding it at levels that really are causing us concern. As a result of that, we're having to do some things that we wouldn't have had to do a number of years ago, which is we're developing water quality criteria for surface waters for these perfluorinated compounds to make sure that the levels that we're going to see in the water in the future are going to be back down to acceptable levels, and we're not going to see the levels of contamination that we see today. The four sites in particular that you're hearing about are as follows. There's the Oakdale site, and cleanup is already underway, and there's additional cleanup that we're expecting 3M to do, and we've got a proposal coming in from them shortly. What we will do is we'll take a look at it, and we'll evaluate their proposal. If we think it's satisfactory, we'll give them the green light to do it. If we think there are more things they need to do or different things they need to do, we will tell them that, and they will follow up appropriately. There's a Washington County landfill, which is in the closed landfill program. We own that landfill, and we are responsible for the remediation, and we're working on plans to address that as we speak. There's also contamination coming from land disposal at the actual Chemolite facility in Cottage Grove. Once again, we've got a full 3M report on their investigation and recommendations due in April, and as soon as we get that from them, we're going to move quickly to evaluate it and make sure the appropriate actions are taken, and that should happen this working season as well as the next. The last site is a disposal site in Woodbury, and the same situation exists there. We're going to be getting a plan from 3M here shortly, and we'll be asking them to take the appropriate actions to remediate that. In addition to that, since fiscal year 2005, we have expended approximately $1 million on a variety of activities on PFCs, and that includes research and development sorts of activities to try to figure out exactly what's happening in the environment with these compounds, as well as oversight of regulated party activities. Within the recent year, that's included about $600,000 to fund a variety of projects such as fish tissue sampling, evaluating PFCs in wastewater effluents, and things of that nature.
Has 3M contributed to any of those costs?
Madam Chair, they have. In some cases, they have actually paid for the installation of new filtration systems in a couple of communities so that the residents that are drawing municipal well water are getting clean water. So they've made those capital investments. They have also made other investments in investigation and remediation. There will be quite a bit more in the future. Any costs that we incur as a result of this contamination, they have to pay us for. So the way it typically works is we will do the work, we will oversee their work, and then we'll send them a bill. Now on to the Superfund program. And on these land programs, I'll actually touch on these fairly briefly. I talked a little bit about Superfund as it relates to PFCs, and I think that gives you a flavor for what the program looks like and how it works. But it's a program that's actually had quite a bit of success over the years and is seen as a model in the country for successfully cleaning up sites. There are a number of states across the country where they just can't get off of square one and clean up old contaminated sites. We've been quite a bit more successful. We've had 159 sites cleaned up since 1980, which has protected drinking water for 24 communities and 700,000 residents. The number of sites that are coming in every year are less and less because we know more and more about the historic contamination sites. We currently have 96 active sites, and we're projected to work on several dozen over the next biennium.
Now, Mr. Rodese, I think it was the last budget cycle where the governor's budget slowed down the funding for some of the cleanup, slowed down the schedule for cleanup of some Superfund sites. Has that schedule changed?
Madam Chair, and I misspoke on this in the overview, that was the proposal that we made to try to deal with the budget deficit at the time. It ultimately did not end up in the legislation that was passed, so those projects were not delayed. That is always an option. So if it turns out that we have an unanticipated large expenditure for some site, we may end up delaying some other site for some period of time so that we can do it within the budget.
That's what I thought. Yeah, I was thinking that some were delayed and some were not. So maybe we could get some feedback on that if you don't have it right now, just to let us know if there were some that were put to the end. Because I remember there were three. Well, I remember the list vaguely, not in detail. So that sounds right, Mr. Knopf is saying.
Madam Chair, we'll get that information
get back
for
to
you.
Us on
yep. Okay. One quick example, another example of how a Superfund site is actually acted upon is the Interlake Superfund site up in the northern corner of the state. And this is an old site with contamination dating back to the 1890s. We have three regulated parties who are working on the cleanup. We just recently reached an agreement for how this is going to take place and what was an acceptable proposal for cleaning it up. It started in 2006. It's going to complete in about 2009 at a price tag between $50 and $70 million. The next program I'd like to talk about briefly is the Petroleum Remediation Program, and this is the program that we use to address leaking underground storage tanks. And it's been in existence for about 20 years, and we've had 14,000 sites cleaned up, cleaning up 2 million cubic yards of soil, which is the equivalent of about 300 football fields, 3 feet deep. It's quite a bit of soil that's been remediated. And we've also remediated quite a bit of groundwater as a result. It's a good program, one that continues to be needed as we find additional leaking tanks in the ground. Closed landfill program is unique to Minnesota, and it's a program that was started in 1994 as an alternative to dealing with landfills that would otherwise be considered Superfund sites. And the way the program works is the state has taken over ownership and responsibility for a number of sites. At this point, we have 109 sites in the program, and the state has assumed the long-term obligation for making sure that the sites are either cleaned up if they haven't been already and appropriately managed into the future. As we've seen with the PFCs, there are occasionally situations that we encounter with landfills that we've taken over with new issues, with new remediation necessary. So there's an ongoing need to make sure that there are sufficient funds to support this program. The next program is a voluntary investigation and cleanup program. And this is, again, another innovative program that has been copied by some states. But the idea here essentially is to provide an opportunity for folks who want to redevelop property that has historic contamination to work with us and to pay us to be their technical experts and to also work with them on cleanup plans that will absolve them of any future liability so they can return sites to productive use. We've overseen 2,900 contaminated properties since the program's inception in 1988, and this has resulted in over 14,000 acres of land being returned to productive use. It's particularly useful in metropolitan areas, blighted areas where you need properties that have had historic contamination can be returned to productive use and providing a boon to the local economy.
Do you have any idea how many sites like that there are around the state?
Madam Chair, how many sites currently?
Yeah.
I don't have that number in front of me right now, but we can either get that right now or later date.
Sure. Senator Kubley?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just back up to that closed landfill program, Commissioner. You know, when you collect that methane gas is that a commercially viable product or not?
Madam Chair, Senator, it is. In fact, what we are striving to do is to collect this gas as much as possible because it is a greenhouse gas, and to try to convert it to electricity. There's a project that we just got underway in Andover, where we're capturing the methane gas from the landfill, and it's going to generate about 220 kilowatts of energy. The estimates from our staff is if we were to collect all the methane from all the closed landfills in the program, we would capture about 10 megawatts of energy. It's not always commercially feasible. It kind of depends on the location of the landfill and technically what's feasible, but it definitely is something we're looking at, and we're trying to increase the capture of this gas.
Senator Kublai, I'm pretty sure I put that definition in the RAS bill that just passed as another type of renewable energy, landfill gas. I think we count that as a renewable now under the new bill.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I've been rattling off the things that were eligible there, and I haven't mentioned that, so I guess I'll have to add one.
It's getting longer. The list is a little bit longer, not a lot. I think we added methane digesters, which was really more of a clarification, I think.
Okay.
And landfill gas. I'm pretty sure that's what was, not having it right in front of me, not having looked at it for 2 weeks, I'm on to other things.
I understand.
Go ahead, please. Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, as long as we ask a question on a closed landfill program, I have another question on that same program. When we established this program in 1994, we authorized the sale of something like $30 million worth of bonds. And some of those got caught in a bond cancellation clause of state law. And since then, we've been reauthorizing the sale of those bonds. Have we lived up to the state obligation for this? No. We promised, I believe it was some $30 million of bonded money from the state. Have all of that been authorized? Are there going to be additional requests for bonding dollars for this program?
Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Rod Massey, the agency CFO, to respond to that question.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Massey.
Madam Chair, members, Rod Massey, Pollution Control Agency. Senator Fredrickson, the initial, I think, authorization was almost $90 million. And when it was canceled, there was a considerable amount of left to do. We now go back every 2 years for that. We're about between $8 and $10 million short of that authorization. We will come back, though, to the governor anyway for bonding money next year. So we get a certain amount every 2 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am now on slide 22, the Emergency Response Program. This is a very, very key function of the agency. It's in terms of staffing, it's a small portion of the agency, but it's a 24/7 operation that we have in place to deal with the over 2,000 incidents that we see on average every year. And these are everything from your garden variety spills to major fires. And typically what happens is the responsible party, if there's a spill, is essentially on the hook for paying all the costs of the cleanup, including our own staff time. On occasion, we don't know who the responsible party is or they're recalcitrant, in which case we go after them with an enforcement action and recover our costs. But generally speaking, that's a fairly small percentage of what we see in this program. Again, it's a very important activity, one I don't want to understate, and it's one that I think we do very, very well. On to hazardous waste management. The goal of this program essentially is to make sure that the hazardous waste that's generated in the state is managed appropriately, and that means that it's either recycled or reused or disposed of in a manner that's environmentally appropriate. Minnesota's businesses and institutions generate about 250,000 tons annually, and it's through the permits that we issue and the licenses that we issue to these folks, which is about 18,000 permits and licenses, folks are basically required to manage these wastes appropriately, and we think they do that fairly well. We have a pretty decent compliance record on hazardous waste in the state. There are other issues that we see in our hazardous waste program that sort of fall out of the standard program protocols, and I wanted to give you one example because I think it's a good example of how we've used prevention to deal with an emerging issue, which is the introduction of endocrine-disrupting chemicals into the environment. We began a hazardous waste initiative for the healthcare industry not too long ago because we had a belief, which we backed up with data, that many hospitals really weren't managing their hazardous waste appropriately. So we entered into a partnership with some metro counties, with the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program and the Minnesota Hospital Association to try to address this problem. And it's been a very effective effort. And to date, the results we've gotten is that 75 tons of pharmaceuticals have been prevented from getting into the waste stream. Oftentimes, these wastes would end up into the water waste stream and would, of course, end up in our waterways where there's a lot of concern about endocrine receptors. And this is one of the kinds of initiatives that we like to talk about and focus on because they're good prevention initiatives that go beyond what is typically required in the hazardous waste program. On a solid waste management, this is a long-standing program at the agency that is responsible for overseeing the management of solid waste landfills in the state. And we have 21 municipal solid waste landfills in the state, 100 demolition landfills, 35 industrial landfills, and a little over 100 transfer stations. We permit all these activities, and we have a very good compliance rate. We have inspectors located throughout the state in our regional offices who inspect these facilities at least once a year. Our permits are largely up to date. 90% of them are up to date. And to date, we have our estimates are that 75 million gallons of leachate, and this is the water-like runoff that comes off of landfills, 75 million gallons has been appropriately collected and treated as a result of this program. The last part I'll talk about is environmental assistance, which will lead us into, it's a segue into the next programmatic area, which is environmental assistance. But our vision for environmental assistance is that Minnesotans take responsibility for protecting our environment. And these activities are not only focused on solid waste prevention, which has been historically where these activities have been focused, but also reducing air and water pollution as well. On the next slide, just to give you a sense of how these activities fall out in the agency, we have activities that are focused on recycling, and we have done these activities for many, many years. We also have waste prevention efforts, a lot of which is focused on the business community. We think that our efforts with the business community have resulted in savings of nearly $4.5 million in the last 2 years and has prevented or reused nearly 12 million pounds of waste that otherwise would have been disposed of. We think this has also conserved 36 million gallons of water and conserved 1.3 million kilowatt hours of electricity. We also had a very, very successful event at the State Fair last year, which Commissioner Moore talked about a few weeks ago. We had over 350,000 visitors to the Eco Experience, which was an exhibit intended to show Minnesotans how they can make environmentally better choices. It was the second most popular exhibit at the fair. The environmental assistance work, by and large, falls within our prevention and assistance division. So most of the OEA employees from the previous organization, Office of Environmental Assistance, have landed in the Prevention and Assistance Division. As you can see on the pie chart on slide 29, it's also the simplest funding source for any of the programs in the agency. Just about all of it comes from the Environmental Fund, the bulk of which is in the nature of SCORE grants. It's spent in the nature of SCORE grants. We also have a budget initiative that will be out of the Environmental Assistance Program, which I'll be talking about in a few minutes, which has to do with supporting renewable fuels and retrofitting school buses. I'd like to talk a little bit about the trends that we see in waste management and how it relates to the activities that we are intending to do in environmental assistance in the coming years. If you look at the slide on page 30, you can see that overall the tons per year of waste that are generated by Minnesotans has been climbing every year. Currently, as of 2005, municipal solid waste generation rate was 6 million tons, or about 1 ton per person per year. This is growing on average of about 2% per year. Now, we have a very high recycling rate. It's 41%, but it's been staying at 41% for a number of years. And that's a good thing, but on the other hand, it's not keeping up with the increase in waste generation. So we're seeing more and more landfilling, and we're also seeing less waste-to-energy conversion of waste. Our objective is to try to get this turned around and to try to increase the recycling rate, which I'll talk about on the next slide, which is our waste management objectives. What you see here is a projection going out to 2012 of where we'd like to see the system be. And our objective for recycling is pretty simple. We think we should and can get to a 50% recycling rate by 2011. And we also want to bump up our waste energy and organics composting rate to 35% by 2011. If we did this, we think that we would avoid 2.6 million tons of carbon dioxide getting into the air and conserve an additional 15 trillion BTU every year. Okay, back to environmental assistance. And I'll just spend a brief few moments talking about what we're focusing on in environmental assistance to try to mitigate that increase in waste generation. There's a wide variety of activities in environmental assistance, so this is just a sampling of what it is that we do. To think about the markets for waste, this is really focused on the recycling industry. And the data that we have been generating over the years, and we have a fairly good understanding of the economics of this industry, is our estimates are that 15,000 jobs have been created in this business sector alone, which represents about $2.5 billion of gross economic activity. What we do is we try to provide support to this industry to help them be successful. So we have experts in the field of recycling that work to develop markets, alternative markets for substances that currently don't have a recycling market, anything that we can do to make good use of waste that would otherwise end up in landfills. The eco experience is one of those activities directed at the consumer level, and it's probably the most visible one. But every day we have staff working with businesses and business associations to reduce waste, and they're very successful. Probably the most important component of our activities to reduce waste in the state lies at the county level. The way we support the county recycling and waste prevention programs is through SCORE. And as many of you know, back in 2004, the SCORE funds to the counties were reduced by $1.5 million per year because of the budget situation at that time. It was made fairly clear to us that the legislature had hoped to restore those funds when the budget situation improved, and we feel that we are in that situation today. So we do have a change item that the governor's budget is recommending, which is that we restore those reductions in the SCORE funding of $1.5 million per year over the biennium. We think that this is very important to signal support to the counties that we do understand and value the importance, but it's also important for the rural county programs, which are especially affected by reductions in the SCORE funding. The counties are required to match these funds by 25%.
Senator Paraso.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ruiz, when the $1.5 billion will be restored, what changes will there be in the use of those dollars in the programs? As long as you've had some successes in some areas, will there be changes?
Mr. Ruiz.
Madam Chair, our relationship with the counties continues to evolve, and we expect more and more of them, whether it's in county recycling programs or in the county feedlot programs. And it's our intention that as we move forward, and we've already had discussions with the counties on issues such as e-waste, is that it's important for us to increasingly demonstrate results for the dollars that we send their way. We think we're doing better. We think we do a lot better yet. And I think that with the restoration of these dollars, it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we make those expectations clear, and I think we will do so.
Madam Chair, specifically, would there be any change in some of the uses out there, or if they've kind of maxed out on what they can in particular fields of collecting or usage or prevention, where would the next best place to put that dollar be?
Madam Chair, if I may, Kathy Mulder here, who's the director of the Prevention and Assistance Division, who might be able to provide a better answer than I can.
Ms. Moger, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Moger. I'm the Division Director for Prevention and Assistance. What we saw as a result of the SCORE reductions is that a number of the rural counties in particular either scaled back their programs or in some cases dropped elements of their programs altogether. So with the increase of the $1.5 million per year, what we're hoping to see is that, for example, Big Stone County would put back its household hazardous waste collection program, which is something that they closed when the dollars were reduced to them, that we'd start to see Winona and Wabasha come back in to the Southern Minnesota marketing program so that they could collect different types of materials and have better markets. So we're just hoping to see basically a restoration of rural recycling that really was impacted by this last budget cut.
Thank you.
So, I think it's a good strategic goal to try to increase recycling to 50% statewide, but how do you do that? It sounds like this money will really just restore what we were doing before. How do we get to that increased rate?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we have two things that we're working on right now through what we call a reinvigorate recycling program. And the first element of that is basically targeted at the residential market and reminding people of how much recycling opportunities are available in the state through a public awareness campaign. And we're working with both non-metro counties and metro counties to design that program right now. We think that we'll be testing it in a rural area first to see how well it works. Then the second effort is really oriented towards commercial recycling. We're doing a waste composition study. We're trying to figure out the sectors that have the most potential for recycling, for waste left in the waste stream, and then really target our efforts towards getting the additional capacity that they need, helping them figure out how to put programs into operation. So we have a very targeted approach towards the commercial side and a more general public education awareness focus for the residential side.
Okay. Senator Saxon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I realize it's in its infant stages, but do you have any opinion on the future for plasma gasification? International Falls has got some money for a potential unit up there.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxog, I know a little bit about that facility. I think it's intriguing, and if it's something that would work in the way they intend it to, I think it could be a good thing. Some of the questions that I've heard about the actual feasibility of the project, which I think would be good to know before it gets too far along, but I think it does seem to hold some promise for dealing with the waste issues, especially in remote areas.
Senator Saxon.
Well, Madam Chair, Commissioner, it is proven technology. It's Japanese technology, I believe. So, anyway, we'll all watch it. But I would hope that, particularly in rural Minnesota, it would be a way to take care of some garbage problems.
Is that plant moving forward?
Moving forward, Madam Chair, it's all in the stages, as we all know. But the money for the study of it is there, so we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. All right, great. Go ahead, please.
Okay, with that, I'll move into the air portion of the budget. This is on page 34. Our vision for Minnesota's air quality is pretty simple. It's that the air is clean and the air is clear. And for us, that breaks down in a couple of different things. For clear, it's obviously about visibility, and that's whether it's in the urban areas or in rural and scenic areas, such as the Boundary Waters or Voyageurs National Park. In terms of clear air, that typically relates to whether or not we're meeting federal ambient air quality standards for what's considered to be healthy air, as well as what we consider to be healthy versus unhealthy levels of toxic air pollutants. Clean air means healthier people. That's pretty clear. The science is very, very clear on this. And we know that if people breathe, and when people breathe dirty air, it can cause a number of forms of irritation, whether it's itchy eyes, more than irritation to conditions such as asthma, bronchitis, heart conditions, or even worse, leading to cancer. So this is an issue that we take very, very seriously. We do everything we can to meet what we think are pretty ambitious goals to clean the air in the state. And the air in the state is, relatively speaking, pretty good. Back in 1970, the Federal Clean Air Act established what it considered to be acceptable levels of air pollution for six different pollutants. And their standards, the federal standards, have changed periodically over the years, as they're required to do under the Federal Clean Air Act. We know that even with those changes at the federal level, that there are days that even though we meet the federal standard in general, there are days that the air is not clean enough for sensitive individuals or athletes, and we have had to issue air advisories over over the last few years, primarily in the metropolitan area, but also outstate for things such as particulate and ozone pollution. So we're doing everything we can to keep levels down and to get them further down as we move forward. The air work in the agency happens in three divisions. Most of the air work that we do takes place in the industrial division, which is where we regulate facilities and set conditions on industrial and municipal facilities that emit air pollution. The Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division is where we do our air quality monitoring and assessment. It's where our scientists are housed and where we do any work as it relates to standards or air advisories. And the Prevention and Assistance Division is where we do what it sounds like. Prevention and assistance activities focus on individuals, focus on things such as mobile sources, cars, buses, things of that sort. We have an initiative that I'm about to talk about in just a couple of minutes, and that work would largely take place in the Prevention and Assistance Division. The total appropriations for the air program is $23.7 million. A small portion of this is projected to be from the general fund, which is new for the air quality program. And this amount, which is $2.28 million, is part of an initiative that I'll be talking about in just a minute to support the agency's activities in regulating ethanol and mining facilities in particular. The bulk of the support for this program comes out of the Environmental Fund, $20.3 million. $19.5 million of that is for air permitting, so it's basically that's a fee that facilities pay as a result of having permits in the state. As far as how we're doing in Minnesota, I said that the air is good, but we could do better. I think this slide says it as well as I can say it. If you take a look at the various lines in the graph, I'll point out a few in particular. The top line that indicates the state's real gross state product, as you can see, the economy is growing at a fairly healthy clip. What that means is you have more sources of pollution, whether it's businesses or individuals driving cars or what have you. As you get economic growth, you tend to get more emissions. But if you look at the green line at the bottom of the graph, which is it's the category of sort of traditional pollutants that you get out of industry, those have been heading downward for quite some time and are quite low. So even though we've had substantial economic growth, we've done a really good job within our standard permitting and regulatory programs of keeping those emissions down. I think the real challenge lies in a couple of the other lines that you see on the graph. One is vehicle miles traveled, which is the second from the top. That continues to go up at a fairly healthy clip. And as we have more vehicle miles traveled, we get more pollution from motor vehicles. And it's one of the issues that we're particularly concerned about in terms of meeting the federal ozone standard into the future. We're also seeing an increase in carbon dioxide emissions in the state at 53%. And that's a pretty high rate. And it's something that we're concerned about and we'd like to bring down. Now, the next slide will just give you a sense of what things look like for the ambient air quality standards that the federal government sets and what the conditions look like in the state. What you see on this slide is just the trends in various parts of the state for particulate matter. Now, we can make these kinds of graphs because air quality is reasonably easy to measure from kind of a broad scale. Air disperses fairly widely. You can get a fairly good understanding of what the air is like in various regions of the state. It's much more difficult to do that with water where you have discrete water bodies. But air is actually not that difficult to measure for these kinds of pollutants. If you look at the particulate matter levels in the state, they have been trending downward fairly steadily over the last several years. The two lines that you see at the top of the chart, the solid line, the PM2.5 standard of 15 micrograms per cubic meter, that is the standard, the federal standard that exists today. So we need to stay below that or we're violating the federal ambient air quality standard. We're quite a bit below that, as you can see. The dotted line is a new standard that has been proposed by EPA's Clean Air Science Advisory Committee. And as you can see, we'd still be below that level, but we're getting closer. Where EPA actually ends up setting its final standard will be somewhere in between that dotted line and the current solid line, but we know it'll be somewhere within that range. I do want to repeat, however, that even though we're meeting the air quality standards in general, there are definitely days, particularly in the wintertime, where we have elevated levels of particulate matter, which affect particularly sensitive individuals, but really affect all of our health. The next chart gives you a sense of what things look like with regard to toxic air pollutants as far as we know. This chart describes the level of benzene at our monitoring stations where we monitor for benzene. And as you can see, the trend has been downward, and that's a good thing. And the reason for this result is that cars have been getting cleaner, fuels have been getting cleaner. There was some action taken by the legislature several years ago to require gas stations to capture their vapor. That also has a side effect of reducing benzene concentrations. So the trends here are good. We monitor for 80 of the 188 known or federally designated toxic air pollutants, so there's a lot that we still don't know. We think the trends are generally good. However, there are facilities that come our way that emit levels of pollution, toxic air pollution, that will be above levels that we consider appropriate, and we typically work with them to get their permits to limit those levels to acceptable levels. The last slide I'll show about the environment and the condition of the environment has to do with what we're targeting in terms of reducing ozone warming air pollution. We've set a fairly aggressive goal that by 2011 we'll reduce the emissions that contribute to fine particle and ozone pollution by 30%. When we set this goal, we didn't know that Xcel Energy was going to propose their emissions reduction project. We didn't know that other emissions reduction projects, such as the Minnesota Power Project, were going to come to be. We set it as a stretch goal that we hoped would push activities like theirs forward. That's by no means the only reason that those activities have taken place, but we have been very, very clear about what our expectations are for reducing ozone and fine particle pollution in the state, even though we meet the standards. So you can see, according to this graph here, that by 2018, we will by far exceed our 30% goal. Sometime between 2009 and 2018, we're estimating at about 2013, we will meet our 30% goal. At that time, we'll evaluate it and decide a new goal that we need to set so we can keep moving emissions downward. Next, I'll talk about the air regulatory program. And this is the basic foundational program of the air program. We have issued permits for many, many years, and we are required to do this by the Federal Clean Air Act. How each state does this is a little bit different. Our program is a little different from Iowa's, which is a little bit different from Illinois's. But for the large facilities, we all have to basically treat the players the same. We do permit over 3,000 facilities in the state. A large number of these are what we call registration permits, which are your small and medium-sized businesses. But we do have roughly 400 individual permits for the larger facilities, and this is everything from the ethanol plant down the street to a 3M facility to a small manufacturing facility that has large emissions, things of that sort. These permits are very important for protecting the environment because they reduce the amount of pollution that would otherwise be emitted if we didn't have the permit. There are many, many conditions and record-keeping requirements that are required of facilities that have permits. And if you were to look at the total amount of emissions that would go into the environment absent these permits and conditions, it would be quite significant. One way of measuring the impact of our regulatory activities is on the next slide, and it has to do with our enforcement activities. There's been a movement in the last several years among states who do air quality enforcement to try to measure the environmental impact of the enforcement activities that we undertake. It's sort of an emerging activity, and it's one that will only get better over time. We decided to start doing this last year because we felt that we were starting to get data that was good enough to be able to track and report on. So for last calendar year, the cumulative total of pounds that we believe that have been prevented or eliminated as a result of our enforcement actions is 640,000 pounds of air emissions. This is through 115 formal actions that we've taken that have penalties ranging or up to or totaling $333,000 for the calendar year. We will report on this on an ongoing basis. We track this quarterly, and we think it's an important way to continue to send the message to our enforcement program that it's not just about penalties and taking actions. It's about making sure that what we do results in actual environmental improvement. The next two issues I'd like to talk about are our two very, very important initiatives. The first one is the Green Technologies Initiative. We also call it our Green Cubed Initiative because it's about green fleets, green fuels, and green energy. And this is part of the governor's overall strategy of promoting the use of alternative fuels and accelerating the transition to cleaner energy sources. What we're requesting in our budget is a total of $3 million over the biennium, $1.5 million per year. The majority of this funding, $1 million per year, would be to fund the introduction of retrofit technology, so basically putting on an end-of-the-pipe solution to school buses on the road to reduce their particulate emissions. We think that by adding this $1 million a year to the agency's budget, we'll be able to have 500 bus engines retrofitted, which will improve the health for 30,000 children. What this in effect is, it's a simple control technology, but it does cost money that you can put on any bus on the road and significantly reduce the air pollution. What we have found in our work on this area is that as we spend state dollars, federal and private partners usually kick in more than a matching amount. We estimate that there are 4,000 buses on the road that carry 250,000 students every day. We believe that this initiative will jumpstart even further investment in the private sector and the federal government grant-making process to get us so that all the buses in the state are retrofitted and diesel particulate emissions are reduced to the greatest extent possible. The bulk of the rest of the initiative is about $300,000 that we would send to our small business environmental loan program. In recent years, we received authority to expand the scope of this program to fund these kinds of activities. And what these dollars would do is they would primarily be spent on supporting efforts at small trucking firms to install cleaner burning equipment so that they could actually emit less diesel particulate pollution.
Okay, so go ahead, Senator.
Go ahead. I'll defer to the chair, Madam Chair.
I'm just thinking about my question here. So how many school buses will you be able to retrofit again with this increase? How much of the money is going to the school bus retrofits, did you say?
Madam Chair, $1 million, and that's 500 retrofits at an average of $2,000 per bus.
Okay, so you're actually paying for the equipment or the labor to do the retrofit?
I'm sure that's correct.
So 500 buses, and you said there's, 4,000 in the state, something like that?
Madam Chair, Kathy Moger, our expert on this issue.
All right, welcome back. Ms. Moger?
Actually, the $1 million is funding both the $300,000 of small business loans for the auxiliary power units for the semi-trucks, basically, and then the remaining money, $700,000, is going for the diesel oxidation catalysts on the school buses.
Okay, so how do you pick which school buses? Is it district by district?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we have been working with a number of school districts through Project Green Fleet, which is through Clean Air Minnesota, a voluntary effort, and we are both identifying willing school district partners and also school bus companies that would be willing to work with us. And so we have a list of areas that we would focus on. When the program first started, which is only just a little over a year ago, we targeted three areas based on air quality: the metro area, Duluth, and Rochester. With this money, we would be going statewide.
Okay. So, but you're still going to be picking and choosing some school buses and not others.
That's right, so, Madam Chair.
So I thought I heard you say 4,000 school buses total. Did you say that? So to do this statewide, it would take?
$8.3 million, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are you going to come back and ask for more to try to finish it?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, actually, we hope to be substantially along on the leveraging process with both federal funds and with private contributions, so that we think this will be our only state dollar request. If not, we'll have to reconsider during the next biennial budget.
So that eight and some million, you think you'll be able to get the whole state done ultimately without any more?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, that's correct, but within 4 years, not two.
Uh-huh. And do you focus on the smaller children first?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Project Green Fleet does have one grant program or one grant that they received from Blue Cross Blue Shield to target Head Start buses. We did not start with Head Start buses because we don't know how many there are and where they are. And so that's part of the grant that we were given, was actually to identify that for the state and be able to develop a program that would target those. So we went with the low-hanging fruit, basically, with the school buses that we knew were out there and needed the retrofits.
I would think that, you know, if we can't do all the school buses, we should start with maybe the elementary kids, because their bodies are smaller and the impact of toxins is higher the smaller they are.
And Madam Chair, the other thing that we have considered looking at is the length of time on school buses. So maybe for the rural areas in particular, where kids are riding school buses for, you know, as much as an hour, that we would look at also the length of time on the bus.
My kids now at their school in St. Paul, they have some hour bus rides, so keep it in mind. But yeah, that's a good idea to focus on the longer rides. Senator Fredrickson, did I ask all your questions?
Madam Chair, most of them, but I was concerned with how long it was going to take to retrofit all of the buses, because I could see school districts and parents getting very concerned about this. And I'm curious if there is enough equipment, enough of these devices available, so that this could be done on an accelerated basis?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, actually, one of the partners that are one of the groups that we're working with in this is Donaldson Corporation, located here in the state. And they actually produce these oxidation catalysts to a national market. And we believe that we have enough.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Mulger, some of the school buses, I believe, are owned by the districts themselves, and some are contracted. Would there be an opportunity to have those districts that are going out for new contracts to include in their contracts the requirement that the buses for which they contract have these devices on them? And then perhaps through our transportation funding of the schools, have a slightly higher payment for those districts that do that?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, you bring up a really good point that what we're proposing to work with here is what's called the legacy fleet. And federal law has already required new school buses to have this equipment installed on them. Basically, that started happening in 2006. So what we're dealing with are the school buses that are on the road for about 20 or 30 years before they, you know, end their useful life. The oldest school buses, of course, would get replaced with this newer equipment, so we don't think it's cost-effective to retrofit those because they would be replaced within a year or two with the new bus.
Madam Chair, I think we should have some discussions with Senator Stumpf about this also.
I think we should. And I don't know what schedule the districts are on in terms of replacing their buses. Given all the budget cuts that they've been facing, I wouldn't be surprised if that's being delayed from what's ideal. Thank you. Are you the other part of the other $500,000? Do you want to explain that to Ms. Mulger? Is that your territory?
It sure is. Thank you, Madam Chair. The other areas that we'd be focusing on are green fuels and green energy. Basically, we'd be using our existing environmental assistance competitive grant program to foster both additional public education for use of E85, so we'd be doing this in cooperation with Department of Commerce and Department of Agriculture. And then the second piece of it is energy efficiency projects, this in cooperation with Department of Commerce, really trying to emphasize small business projects that could increase energy efficiency for those areas. An example might be the Capitol Complex has a number of vending machines, and there's a product called the Vending Miser that basically cycles the energy on and off for those vending machines that significantly reduces the amount of energy that is needed to heat or cool that area. That would be an example.
So you mean you'd be, what, installing these or just telling people about them?
Madam Chair, helping to provide, using grants to provide incentives for people to install those. So, for example, the Minneapolis School District just came to us wanting funding to help install these vending misers in the school district to help save energy. And so we'd be helping them develop their contacts, their plan, and then their payback costs.
I've heard that the electronic devices that are on standby is one of the hugest users of electricity these days. That's, you know, not accounted for. And do you have any kind of recommendations there for what you can do?
Madam Chair, you're above my technical capability here, but I'd be happy to go back and find out if there are some additional ideas.
Okay, and we can talk to the Commerce Department. They may have some information about that too. All right, so the E85, you'd basically be just doing
we'd be, Madam Chair, we'd be trying to increase use for, you know, part of the governor's initiative is really increasing the number of stations that offer E85. We would be focused on the public education aspect of that because that's something that we do for recycling and other areas.
Okay. All right, any other questions?
Madam Chair, Ms. Morgan, I do have a question about the vending machines and those devices. Most certainly those vending machines have to be kept within certain temperature parameters to keep the food products safe for consumption. Is that a concern? Is that under control?
Are they Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, absolutely. What it does is it reads how cold the product, or how cold or how hot the product is, and it cycles on and off based on that.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Moeller, now those devices run continuously? Is that what happens?
Madam Chair and Senator Fredrickson, yes, that's the case. So they, no matter how, what the product needs, it's on continuously.
All right. So that, all right, thank you very much.
The next slide on page 44 is the beginning of a discussion on our second major initiative, which we're calling ethanol mining and economic development, for lack of a better term. The first chart that you're looking at, I think, will just give you a sense of the pressures that the agency is facing in terms of the number of permits that we're seeing coming our way. We have, I think, done a very, very good job over the last several years to bring the timelines for air and water quality permitting down to historic levels so that our backlog of expired permits is in the neighborhood of 10%. What that means is that 90% of our permits are current. And it also means that we're able to issue permits expeditiously so that folks who want to get businesses off the ground can get the construction happening as soon as possible. Within the last year and a half, we have seen a tremendous demand on the agency's resources, largely due to the beginning of some very good things in two industries. We're seeing a lot of development in the ethanol industry, and we're seeing a lot of development in the mining industry. These are two industries of great importance to the state. However, what that has meant for the agency is that we don't have sufficient staff to be able to address all the permitting needs and the environmental review needs that represents. The graph you're looking at is a projection of what we think our permitting timelines are going to look like if we don't receive additional resources to deal with this great influx in permits. So you can see that as of about 2006, 2007, the curve starts heading back upward to the levels that we had maybe about 5, 6, 7 years ago. It's not something we want to see happen. To mitigate against this trend, we're doing a couple of different things. One is we are continuing to work very hard on improving our processes and making sure that we do things as fast as we can at a high quality. We don't want to sacrifice the environment at the expense of speed. The other thing that we've done in the last year is we have shifted significant resources to deal with the issues presented to us by the ethanol mining industry so that we have sufficient staffing to get those permits issued. We moved 16 staff to work on an ethanol team, and we moved 7 staff to work on a mining team. In the ethanol sector, where we have the best data because we have more permits moving forward, prior to setting up that team, the average time of issuance for an ethanol permit and doing the environmental review was roughly 10 months. We've worked that down to where it's 7 months per permit and environmental review. Those are generally done in conjunction. Looking around the landscape, other states, it's our understanding that Iowa gets their approvals for these kinds of facilities done in the neighborhood of 6 months. So we're getting closer to being competitive with other states. The other important thing, though, is by having adequate staffing, we're doing a good quality job on making sure that we're addressing all the environmental issues that present themselves with these facilities. With ethanol in particular, even though the facilities are generally pretty same across the board, the environmental conditions that they find themselves surrounded by are frequently very, very different. So we can't simply do a kind of a cookie-cutter approach like we might with simpler, smaller facilities. We have to evaluate every facility on a case-by-case basis to make sure that air quality is being protected and water quality is being protected. Now, we've made these changes, which has moved 23 staff from their existing programmatic areas into ethanol and mining. And as you can imagine, that means we now have a shortfall in our normal programmatic areas. So we're hearing from other businesses who rely upon us to get them their permits in a timely fashion that things are slowing down. And they are. We know they are. So what we're proposing is to try to address the situation. So I'll take you to the next slide. I've talked about the fact that we have 23 ethanol plants in play, and 8 mining projects. And again, these all require permits and environmental review, in some cases very, very complicated permitting and environmental review. Our permits typically result in some pretty significant reductions in discharges. We just recently permitted an ethanol plant that actually has a zero discharge water quality permit. But what we would like to do is to be able to continue this work that we're doing in the ethanol and mining sectors, but to be able to address the resource shortfall that has created back behind in the old programmatic area. The initiative is from the general fund, and it's in the amount of $3 million per year, which would continue to fund the 23 staff that we're using for ethanol and mining, plus 3 more. And we think we need those to be able to address this really crushing demand, particularly from the ethanol sector. It's only one-time funding, and it's because we believe that on a long-term basis, there needs to be a stable, predictable funding structure to be able to address this need on an ongoing basis. We've had some very preliminary discussions with stakeholders in terms of what kinds of fee structure might work for construction permitting and what the appropriate levels might be, but very, very preliminary. What we think we need to do is, beginning very soon, is to start a stakeholder process with the people who are getting these permits and would be paying fees to figure out what kind of a system we can have, and we would have a proposal for the next legislature to consider for longer-term funding so that we don't need to keep coming back for this kind of bridge funding.
Now, do these proposers have to pay fees already for their permits?
Madam Chair, currently it's mixed. So for, like, say an ethanol plant, if they need to get a construction stormwater permit, there is a construction stormwater permit fee. But as far as their air quality fee, the large fees that they pay on an ongoing basis only kick in when they're operating. They're based upon the emissions that they actually are creating. We don't really have a system where facilities that are doing construction pay for the cost of their permitting. Some states do. Other states don't. It's a little bit of a blend. There's a little bit of construction fee activity, but it's very small.
What would it take for you to get the fee structure in place faster?
You know, Madam Chair, I think it's going to take a little discussion. I think it will probably take us about a year to have a good, thorough discussion, because you have to consider this is not only air but water quality, and they're very, very different constituent groups. So we have to be able to have a discussion with the industrial sector, but also with the municipalities, who, it's my understanding, and I haven't been involved in these discussions in the past, have understandably been reluctant to pay additional fees for construction of new facilities. So I think it would probably take about a year's worth of conversation, and then we'd be able to pull together a proposal and be ready for the next session.
Well, I can understand in the area of wastewater treatment where local units of government are coming to us already to ask for the funding, that if we levied, you know, required them to pay fees for that, it would be sort of like taking from one government unit and giving to another. And but for the ethanol and mining projects, I would think that these proposers would be willing to pay for a permit that would get them, expedite their process so they could get started with construction and get their project going.
Madam Chair, I think that's true. But setting the appropriate fee level and structuring the system in a way that is the most effective, I think will take a little bit of time. Not a lot of time, but it'll take some time.
Just to step back, just agency-wide, I mean, do we have a philosophy that permitting type activities should be covered by the cost, you know, the activities of the agency to issue permits should be covered by the fees of those permits? Is that generally the rule of thumb or not?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, it's again a mixed bag. In the air quality program, we charge operating fees, and we're required to do so by the Clean Water Act Clean Air Act. And we're required to charge fees to cover the cost of the program to manage those operating permits. We're not required to charge fees for the construction permit activity. In water quality, we do charge fees for wastewater treatment plants that range from $1,000 to hundreds of thousands of dollars. It's not adequate to support the entire program.
Yeah, and I know, Senator Frederickson, you commented at our last meeting about how much benefit it brings to rural communities to have these ethanol plants built. And I really agree with that, but I also think they're quite profitable right now, and that they'd probably be willing to pay a fee if they could get their permits expedited rather than waiting around for a year or whatever it may be. And we're talking about, you said 23 staff plus three more, something like that, 26 staff that we need to get these 31 permits out?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So that's almost a whole staff person per permit that you're asking the taxpayers to fund. I just think that's the kind of activity it makes sense should be permit-based, that should be fee-based. If there's anything that's fee-based, that makes sense. Within dollar limits that are reasonable. Comments? Senator Saxhog?
Thanks, Madam Chair. Commissioner, the DNR does some similar funding or permitting for water quality or water permits, excuse me. Do they have a similar mixed bag? Are you aware?
Madam Chair, Senator, even though I've spent 5 months with a former DNR employee, I honestly couldn't give you an answer to that. I don't know how they structure their fees.
That's a good question. I wish I'd asked the DNR the same question. It didn't occur to me. Thank you. We'll have to check with them about that. Senator Frederickson, I think, was next.
Madam Chair, I was just thinking about paying for the increased staff. And this, I believe they said, is a one-time appropriation. And once the facilities are up and operating, then they would be paying, particularly for the air, they would be paying fees on their emissions, which would help pay for the program also.
Well, I think what they're saying is they'll come back in 2 years with a proposal for fees to cover the cost, the permit fees that will cover these staff people, or however many are needed. But in the next 2 years, we're being asked to pay for it out of the general fund, which is, you know, we have a lot of competition for those dollars. So I'm just wondering if we're going to be looking at charging those permit fees in 2 years, why not do it now?
Madam Chair, it seems to me a number of years ago we did have a program in the department, maybe it's still there, where if industry wanted to have an expedited process, they could pay for the expedited process. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's still in place or not, or in place for the industrial.
Mr. Rowdies.
Madam Chair, Senator, we do still have the expedited permit program in place. The way that works as a practical matter doesn't really solve this problem. Part of that is because if you don't have the staff on board, it's essentially the way the program works is that a company can pay the agency an amount to either have a consultant do the permit and the or have staff do it on an overtime basis voluntarily. We don't have the staff on board who understand the industry and are trained in how to do this work. There simply isn't anybody to even volunteer to do the overtime. That's one problem. The other problem is that with these projects, with ethanol and mining in particular, they have been fairly controversial, require a lot of public process, and it's not feasible for us to either do this on an overtime basis or to have contractors do that work.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Ruiz, I have one other fairly unrelated question. In your preliminary remarks on this, you said you had permitted one, I believe you said you had permitted one ethanol project that had zero discharge. Did I hear that right? And if so, would you give us a little more information about that?
Mr. Ruiz.
Madam Chair, Senator, the name of that facility escapes me at the moment. It's Verison.
Where is that?
Welcome, Minnesota.
How did they accomplish that?
Madam Chair, Senator, correct me or kick me if I'm wrong, but I believe that it's what they do with their effluent is they concentrate it into a solid, which is then managed as a solid waste off-site, and they recirculate the rest of their water and recycle it. So there was some controversy in the environmental review process about whether that was ultimately worse for the environment because it takes more energy, but ultimately the environmental review process came to a different conclusion that it was an acceptable alternative.
Okay. Interesting. Senator Bach?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, I don't know if it was in the 05 budget or the 03 budget, we raised air fees by, I think, around 20%. They were pretty significant. And I believe I heard the department say that the current fees, emission fees that are collected, pay for their air quality programs at the department. So that's a Mm-hmm. Those costs are imbalanced, I think. The issue is on construction. And I know I do hear, I think the last number I heard from one of the larger mining projects was that they had already paid $5 million to the department for an existing construction permit. It's in the tune of millions of dollars that I know the mining companies are paying to try, because of the staffing levels are inadequate, that they have to pay because the staff isn't there. It's quite a bit of money gets paid, and I don't know about the ethanol industry, but
yeah, it'd be really interesting to get some kind of idea of how much they're actually paying in fees now. But I guess here we're talking about $3 million to try to get permits for 31 projects. So that's like $100,000 each. No. How much?
$100,000 is right.
$3 million for 31 projects.
Madam
yeah.
Chair, it's 2 years.
Two years.
So that's $200,000.
$6 million.
Yeah, it's $3 million for 2 years in a row.
You're right.
Yeah.
$200,000 total for 2 years, on average. And I don't know whether the mining ones pay more or the ethanol. I don't know. It would be nice to have some information about that and to know how much they're already paying in fees. But, again, the department is saying that they think it should be fee-based, you're just not ready to go yet? How long have you been in this thought process?
Madam Chair, it probably predates my time at the agency, which began in 1990. I think discussions have happened every now and then about whether or not fees are adequate to support the activities that we do at the agency, particularly in the water program. There has historically been a shortfall in our ability to fund our water programs. And a lot of it has had to do with this particular issue. So I think it's been a, from my understanding, it's a problem that's been evolving. We felt it particularly acutely because this industry has come upon us quite quickly. Generally, things don't move that fast, and we don't get as overwhelmed as we did the last year with these new projects. With regard to Senator Bach's comment on the air quality fees, and you'll see in a minute that we have an initiative to increase the operating air quality fees again. That relates to a requirement in the Clean Air Act that we adjust our air quality fees for operating permits, so once they're already constructed, to adjust it according to the Consumer Price Index. And so we periodically come back to the legislature. We have the authority, there's the ability in statute to do this, but we don't have the authority to do it until we're approved by the legislature. So we'll be asking for another fee increase for this biennium for the operating permits. That still does not solve our problem with how do we adequately staff all this construction activity that's happening in the state. And, Madam Chair, we can provide you with details of what various facilities and industries are paying in fees, and we can provide that to you.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, on to the next slide. Now we're jumping into the water program. The vision, similar to AIR, is a fairly clear vision, which is that Minnesota has clean, sustainable surface and groundwater. And we have a few goals that are focused on really the main areas of activity for us. And the first one is assessment. We have a pretty vigorous assessment program that assesses water bodies, lakes, and streams across the state. We also have activities that work to maintain or enhance the water quality in the state. And that could be either regulatory activities such as permitting or enhancement activities such as our grants programs. And then we also have activities that are focused on restoring quality of our water bodies. And that's largely focused in our TMDL program. We do have limited monitoring of what the water quality is throughout the state. We have discovered through our assessment programs that we have about 1,000 lakes and a little less than 300 streams that are impaired in the state. We find that when we assess water bodies, that about 40% of the water bodies that we assess do not meet state water quality standards. And that's fairly typical across the country. Most other states that have monitoring programs are finding about the same rate of impairment. What we don't know is what sorts of levels of things like endocrine disruptors and pharmaceuticals are in the water. I think that's still kind of an emerging science, but that's not part of our conventional monitoring program. The pie chart shows you what the financial picture for the water programs looks like. 39% is out of the general fund, and this includes two new initiatives in the governor's recommendation. One is $2 million of that is from the Ethanol Mining and Economic Development Initiative, and then $21.1 million is represented by the governor's proposal to fund the Clean Water Legacy Act activities. The Environmental Fund is about 30% of the funding for the water quality budget, and that's a variety of activities such as stormwater permitting, wastewater permitting, things of that sort. Water work happens in four different divisions. And in the industrial and municipal divisions, that's where we do our permitting, municipal wastewater treatment plants and industrial facilities that have discharges. The regional division is where we do our feedlot work, as well as the TMDL program, and environmental analysis and outcomes as assessment. The next slide shows you what the picture looks like with regard to discharges from the large facilities in the state. And when we say major sources, that's basically any facility that has a flow rate of over 1 million gallons per day. So these are the big facilities. And what we're finding is that the trends are heading downward, especially with regard to phosphorus. A lot of that is a result of a project that was initiated and is now underway at the Metro plant, which has significantly reduced phosphorus emissions into the river. We've also made pretty good progress in reducing our backlog of permits, and we're down to a situation where roughly 10% of our permits are considered to be out of date. 90% are current. The next two slides talk a little bit about trends that we see across the state in terms of water quality. This is very, very difficult to talk about and for us to even analyze. It's very, as I mentioned before, it's very different from air quality, where you can put monitors in selected portions of the state and get a sense as to what the ambient air quality is, because air mixes fairly readily. With water, you have discrete water bodies, lakes, and streams, and you could have a lake of one quality in one township and a lake of an entirely different level of quality in the next township over. So it's difficult to make statements about trends. However, having said that, we do have some data from our citizen monitoring program that gives us some insight as to what's happening with lakes. For most of the lakes that we monitor through that program, 66%, we have seen no change in water quality in the last couple of years. We see improving transparency in about a third, 28%, but declining transparency in 6%. I think from year to year, you can expect that these numbers, as we assess more and more water bodies, the numbers will get more precise, but they're going to fluctuate a little bit because the number of lakes that we monitor are still small compared to the number of lakes that are actually out there in the state.
Sure. Senator Barroso.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ruiz, on slide 50, showing the percentages there, does the typical use of the lake account for some of the differences, some of the trends in those three sections you show on that slide?
Madam Chair, Senator, I would imagine so, but I couldn't. I would say that it probably depends on from lake to lake. You can find a lake that is naturally probably not as clear as other lakes, but you could find another lake where maybe the clarity is low because you have excess phosphorus coming in from whether it's lawns or other non-point source pollution. It varies quite a bit. It's hard to make a general statement.
It does strike me a little bit that 66% show no change. You'd think there'd be some change in most of the lakes, but yes.
Go ahead, please.
Okay. Next slide, water quality trends in rivers. Again, same statement applies. I think it's difficult to make generalized statements. The one thing we can say is that the top two pie charts and the pie chart on the bottom left indicate that our point source control programs are having the effect that we hope they would, which is that we're seeing reductions in total phosphorus, reductions in total ammonia, bacteria, and even suspended solids. And that's because those are pollutants that are regulated by wastewater at our wastewater treatment plants. The chart on the bottom right, nitrogen, I think is a reflection of the fact that we do still have quite a bit of non-point source pollution occurring in our water bodies, and the trends so far are not terribly encouraging.
Where does most of that nitrogen come from?
Madam Chair, it's largely due to runoff.
Runoff of what?
The majority of the runoff of nitrogen is from feedlot runoff, agricultural runoff, generally non-point source runoff, not the kind you see like in metropolitan areas, which is a different type of runoff.
Jim Hackdale.
Senator Dale.
Well, Madam Chair, members, Mr. Rodis, yes. Okay, the one element that's missing on page 51 is time. If you compare it to your slide 50, you're talking about an 8 to 10-year trend on lake water quality, but you have no dates or number of years on slide 51. And then if you go to slide 49, you're showing a decline in nitrate nitrogen discharges from point sources. And so to me, this page 51 just doesn't jive. You've got all these other measures of lake water or river water quality going down, getting better over some number of years, I don't know how many, but nitrogen sticks out like a sore thumb as being just the opposite. It's a little hard for me to understand that if you're going to blame feedlots and agricultural runoff, why wouldn't the agriculture be contributing to the phosphorus runoff or the bacterial runoff,
right,
or the sedimentation of our rivers, the total suspended solids and so forth? It just doesn't add up that you'd have three measures that are improving and then one that's so dramatically different.
Madam Chair, if I may, Mike Sandusky, the Division Director of our Environmental Analysis Division, could respond.
Thank you.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Weber,
members, Mike Sandusky, Director, Environmental Analysis and Outcomes. Senator, you have an excellent point. Let me provide the context. The previous clarity slide where you point out that the time frame is missing. Context for that is the last, not the last, but near previous 4 years' worth of data. The slide we just referenced is very historical in its context. It represents our milestone sites, some of which we have collected data since the 1950s. So the two time frames are completely different, which partly answers your question. The other part of the comparison that you point out is that the milestone sites, this most recent slide, those have been set up, as I said, for quite some time. And in the original, think a long time ago, in the original context of where we're going to monitor as early in the agency's history, these sites were principally located on large rivers, but reflective of point source discharges, not non-point totally. So this is more reflective of some of the trends in point source control than in non-point source contributions. It's kind of both. I wish I could make it clearer for you, but it's actually both.
Senator Dale.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, my recollection is that when you look at nitrate levels in rivers in this state, you very seldom see any nitrate levels that are above the drinking water standards, which is 10 parts per million or billion, I forget which it is right now. Most of the readings on in the rivers are down around one or half a part per, I forget if it's million or billion. But even the most contaminated river samples that I've seen in the Minnesota River and elsewhere, it usually the nitrate levels are still above the drinking water standard. Now, that's my recollection. Am I right or wrong?
Madam Chair, Senator, you're correct. There's another caution here. The other caveat is this speaks to trends. This graphical information does not speak at all to whether or not we're meeting goals or the standards. So this is just trend information. So if you thought of this as a histogram with a goal line being drawn across the graph, that's not this kind of information. It's simply talking about historical trends.
And Mr. Sandusky, did I hear you say earlier that these long-term monitoring stations were generally put up to measure point sources of nitrogen, nitrates?
Madam Chair, Senator, what I said was confusing because it is confusing. These were established a long time ago. The sites for our initial early phase deployment of monitoring of surface waters in this state. We didn't have a design, an organizing principle for the design other than the fact that we were a regulatory agency. The regulations were totally focused on point source discharges. So these sites are as reflective of point source discharges. They're not in the effluent streams of point source discharges, but they are as reflective of point source control as they are of the purely ambient condition. We have no purely ambient monitoring network at this time.
Okay, I'm going to make one more point. And Madam Chair, members, I've got a booklet that I put out that talks about why livestock is good for the environment and how you can improve the environment with livestock. And that may sound strange to some people, but one of the points that I make in that book is that if you plant alfalfa, which is a nitrogen-loving plant, you need it for horse, cattle, sheep production, and so on, that crop has a very deep root system, and it sucks out almost all the nitrogen in the soil profile. So when you look at what's coming out the tile lines and so forth, there's almost no nitrogen coming off those fields. But if you've got a corn-soybean rotation, you're losing about 30 pounds of nitrogen per acre per year that's going out the tile lines leaving the site. And in a high precipitation year where you've got a lot of rainfall, maybe up to 50 pounds per acre per year that's leaving the site of the corn-soybean rotation. But if you got livestock in the watershed and those alfalfa fields, you've got probably at least 30 to 50 times less nitrogen leaving the site. So on this nitrogen problem you've got down here, what we need to do to solve the problem is to get more livestock in the watershed, because that helps decrease the nitrogen that's leaving that watershed.
Senator Dill, are you talking about having livestock wandering around the fields rather than being concentrated in feedlots? Is that the difference? Because then it's not running off so in larger quantities, is it? It's being absorbed into the soil.
Well, the fact of the matter is that according to the MPCA's own study, the phosphorus components you see right above there, feedlots only contribute 1% of the phosphorus that leaves the state of Minnesota anyway. It's all coming from other sources. So as far as a source of phosphorus from feedlots, it's pretty minor in the overall scheme of things.
Okay, yeah, we're going to run out of time here. I still don't understand why nitrogen is running off and phosphorus isn't. I think that's where you started, Senator Dill. I'm having a little trouble with that.
Well, it's still an unbelievable chart. Maybe it needs to be checked to make sure it's right.
Well, and I think I would have another question, but maybe this we could get an answer later, is you talked about nitrate levels in surface waters and rivers, and I'm wondering about nitrate levels in groundwater, where most of the drinking water comes from. Maybe you could give us an answer on that at a later time. Thank you very much. We do need to keep moving.
Madam Chair, the next slide is on groundwater monitoring. And I'll be just very, very brief because we don't have a lot to say. Just a reminder that prior to 2001, the agency did do some groundwater monitoring and analysis, and that activity was dropped due to budget cuts. And we restarted that on a limited basis in 2003 and then 2004. What this graph merely shows you is that it shows you how many sites we've been doing both condition and trend monitoring of groundwater throughout the state, and our focus is on shallow, vulnerable aquifers. Essentially, the condition sites are the baseline that we're setting for across the state, so we understand what the ambient condition of the groundwater is, and we're going to rotate those, so there are different sites every year. Trend sites are going to be those that we establish, where we're going to go back and repeatedly over time see what the trends are with regard to groundwater and groundwater contamination. We have a report coming out, we think, later this year, and then every 5 years it talks about what results we have. So far, very, very preliminary, not much to say. Very briefly, I'll talk about the regulatory and non-regulatory water programs in the water quality program area, and I'll direct your attention to the second slide on page 54, which shows you how many wastewater treatment permits we have been issuing over the years. And currently, we have a little over 1,500 permits that we issue. It's a significant increase over time, and we have more coming every day. So it's a fairly substantial body of work for the agency. On the next slide, it gives you a sense as to what kind of control we're able to exert on wastewater through these permits. You can see that the amount of solids and biological oxygen demand and even phosphorus that comes into a wastewater treatment plant is quite a bit higher than what comes out. So the purple or the kind of lavender colored bar is what comes in, and the yellow bar is what comes out. The next slide, very briefly, is just once again to reiterate that we have made very good progress in reducing our permit backlog. This actually shows you, this chart shows you how many permits we have current, and currently we're at 91% current. That's a good thing because as permits are current, that means the requirements are up to date, the standards are up to date, and we do a more effective job of protecting the environment. On the following slide, labeled wastewater facility compliance, you can see that the compliance rate is pretty good. And the red bar is for major facilities. Again, that's for the really big facilities with flows over 1 million gallons per day. The yellow bar is everything below that. On average, we have a 94% compliance rate for both the small and the large facilities. That's pretty good, and we have a pretty good handle on what's coming out of facilities because they are required to very regularly submit us discharge monitoring reports that tell us whether they're in or out of compliance. Stormwater permits. We issue three kinds of stormwater permits. The largest category by far is construction stormwater permits. We're required by the Federal Clean Water Act to issue a construction stormwater permit to any project that disturbs more than 1 acre of dirt. Last year, we issued 3,000 permits. Before the change in the federal law, which used to be 5 acres or more, we issued about 900 a year. Industrial stormwater permits, we have 1,800 industrial stormwater permits, again, regulating stormwater runoff from industrial sites. Municipal stormwater permits is where we've seen the biggest change, in that we've gone from only having 2 municipal stormwater permits to 239. And these are permits that are issued to the larger to medium-sized municipalities throughout the state and requires them to tell us how they're going to manage stormwater in their communities. It's an area, I think, of some controversy and quite a bit of work for the agency. In terms of stormwater outcomes, the construction stormwater program is a best management practices-oriented program. In other words, when you have a contractor on site, they are required to implement the best management practices to reduce the amount of runoff that would otherwise go from the site. Our estimates based upon EPA projections is that our permits result in an 80% reduction in solids coming off the site, which would otherwise end up in our rivers and streams and lakes, and an estimated 40% reduction in phosphorus. We think that it's a pretty effective program. It's only going to get more effective as we do this more often and get better data on what the results of our program are. On animal waste management, we issue permits, and the counties issue permits to feedlots throughout the state. There are roughly 30,000 feedlots throughout the state that have some form of regulation, whether it's registration or a permit. We, as the agency, cannot delegate the management of the federally required permits, so we do that, and we have about 1,000 of those permits that we monitor on an ongoing basis. 54 counties have been delegated to run their own feedlot programs, and they regulate the facilities that are below the federal threshold. We are also required by statute to issue permits within 60 days, and we're able to do that 90% of the time. Legislation does give us the flexibility for when we are not able to meet that because it's a more complicated permit, is to double that time frame in agreement with the producer, and we've done that in a few cases. The next slide talks about the results that we've gotten from our non-point source watershed restoration activities. And these are data that we have been able to pull together as a result of projects that we have funded, and we've run through some fairly sophisticated models that talk about reductions. And as you can see, the reductions as of late in 2006, particularly with regard to the phosphorus reduction, are pretty significant. Now, on to the Legacy Act. The Clean Water Legacy Act, last year the agency received one-time funding, and the amounts that you see on the slide. And we have moved very, very aggressively to spend these dollars and to make sure that we get things going fairly, fairly rapidly. We, as a result of the $1.86 million in monitoring and assessment dollars, we were able to add 25 additional watershed sites, 100 additional biological monitoring sites, which is double what we had previously. We added 20 additional lakes to be sampled, and quite a bit more data management. On TMDL development, the $3.17 million has gone to funding 10 new TMDL projects. And we currently have, I believe it's 70 TMDL projects in some form of completion. So it's a fairly hefty percentage that we were able to get started with last year's one-time dollars.
Excuse me, Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Ruiz, of those 70 TMDL projects, how many are you doing entirely as an agency, and how many are being done by a county, a watershed district, or a soil and water conservation district, some other entity?
Madam Chair, Senator, on average, about two-thirds of the TMDLs that we do are done by local units of government or third parties. We do, so it's difficult to say with any precision on the 70. We can get you that number, but it's about two-thirds.
Okay, thank you.
The next slide, the governor has proposed some additional funding for the next biennium, which builds upon the one-time dollars that we received in fiscal year 07. I'll do them in reverse order. I'll talk about water quality assessment first. That dollar figure is the same amount that we received in fiscal year 07. So what we are proposing is that we continue the $1.86 million increase that we received in fiscal year 07 and continue that out into the next biennium. On TMDL development, that figure is double what we received in fiscal year 07, and for us represents a fairly significant increase in investment in doing TMDLs. And with these dollars, we believe that we can begin an additional 20 TMDLs, which would cover roughly 40 listings. In our estimation, this is probably the most that the system overall can handle at this point in terms of our ability to manage the contracts, but more importantly, the contracting community and local units of government. We feel that this is probably the most that we could handle. It's really at the maximum for the next 2 years.
Now, Mr. Rodes, I know we had made a request to find out kind of a list of what the agencies that are involved in the Clean Water Legacy work, what you could do with additional dollars. How much more could we, how many more assessments could be done, how many more TMDLs, and how much effort towards cleanup could we do, and what would that cost?
Madam Chair, I haven't seen the latest submittal, so if somebody here who's more familiar with that wants to speak on that, I can say that in general, with regard to the TMDLs, we did ask our staff very pointedly what they felt the maximum number of TMDLs we could do over the next 2 years was, and that's what this number represents. On assessment,
based on this dollar amount, correct? So if there was more money, if the legislature was able to allocate more dollars, what could we get for that money? That's what we need to know. What could be done? And, you know, we know that this is not even getting us on track to the 10-year schedule of TMDLs, so much less cleanup. And so if we want to clean up our waters faster, I mean, I'm not sure what the timeline is under this budget to actually clean up the waters in Minnesota, but it's decades. So how could we do it faster, and what would that cost is what we're interested in knowing.
Madam Chair, if I may, Paul Eggers, our Clean Water Policy Director, he worked on those figures. And
Senator Anderson, Paul Eggers with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I have been working with Representative Vulgenius and with the House Fiscal Analyst to try to put together some numbers that reflect, I think, what you're asking for. And I guess to start with, start off with where Deputy Commissioner Rodis ended, the $8.71 million per year is roughly what we estimate would be required to address the number of projects scheduled out over the next 10 to 15 years associated with the known list of impairments and what we expect the workload to be over that time. The actual number that we provide in response to Representative Vulgenius' question was about $9 million would allow us to address approximately 25 TMDL projects per year and begin those projects. Senator Frederickson may have something to add. I'm sorry.
Nine additional million?
The governor's recommendation is $8.71 million. Overall, it would be $9 million. So the $8.71 million is roughly what we estimate would be required to address the current list of impairments and what we expect the project list to be over the next 10 to 15 years. Every 2 years, we update the state's impaired waters list, and we reorganize the list of impairments into projects. Some, as Deputy Commissioner Rodis mentioned, many projects address more than one impairment. For example, we do have 2,250 impairments on the 2006 list, but that doesn't mean we're going to have an individual project for each of those. We try to structure things on a watershed basis and take advantage of efficiencies on the ground.
Madam Chair, a short answer on the TMDL projects is that the dollars that we have proposed, we think, keeps us on schedule. Because we are required to do TMDLs 15 years from listing. And at this dollar figure, we feel that we would be able to meet those goals.
Senator Frederickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Rodis, will you have done the monitoring, the sufficient monitoring and assessment to accelerate developing TMDLs beyond what you have in this budget? Or would we be, if we wanted to accelerate it, should we be accelerating it on the assessment and monitoring side?
There you go.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, throughout the development of the Clean Water Legacy Act appropriations, the agencies tried to, we had meetings to discuss where it made sense to concentrate effort, where we could coordinate, and certainly water quality assessment is one of those areas that there's been a great deal of interest in accelerating our level of activity. However, we chose throughout that process to emphasize the need to get going on our TMDL development. So what you see in the Pollution Control Agency's budget and also in the Department of Natural Resources budget is a commitment to moving forward on our level of activity and assessment and monitoring, but really trying to ramp up our level of activity in the TMDL development to get those projects initiated.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Mr.
Frederickson.
Eggers, I guess my question is, have you done enough assessment and monitoring so that you can ramp up the TMDLs?
Mr. Egger.
Madam Chair, I may have to ask Mr. Sandusky to come back to the table to provide a little more context on that question.
Mr. Sandusky.
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, the information I'm going to provide a link here. The information that we also provided to Representative Wagenius related to your point, which is the ramping up of the monitoring and assessment in conjunction with the accelerated TMDL work, accounts to an additional request of $6.317 million per year. And I can go through the bullets, but it basically provides for establishment of more watershed sites, more biological monitoring, more volunteer stream monitoring, more lake assessment monitoring, more volunteer lake monitoring, remote sensing, which helps us target our resources, and data management for the amount of data that we're going to be getting in with that increased assessment.
Madam Chair, maybe we could request to have that information provided to our committee,
yes,
too.
Yes, please. We would like that. Thank you for asking.
Okay, moving on. I'll actually just the next slide on total maximum daily load studies is just meant to show you how much this activity has ramped up over the past 15 years. On to the multimedia budget, which I think will be a fairly simple discussion. The multimedia budget is the place where we fund a couple of different things. One is this is where we have our largest federal grant, which is a multimedia grant. In other words, the EPA sends us dollars according to program, but then kind of turns it into a block grant, into a multimedia grant, and that's how we manage it. And it funds a number of activities in air quality and water quality assessment. We also have some general fund dollars in the governor's recommended budget here, which is part of the Ethanol Mining and Economic Development Initiative. And there's also a little bit of the Environmental Fund. The activities that we do in multimedia really are things that cut across the board in the agency. As you see, they take place in all different divisions of the agency. I'm just going to highlight a few different areas. The first one is mercury. The mercury reduction activities that we are undertaking as a result of all the work that's taken place in the legislature and on the national front are funded out of the multimedia budget. And what this picture intends to show is where we think all these reductions and goals are taking us to the year 2015. All I really wanted to say about this is that it's clear that mercury is an important issue for the agency. We think the funding that we have is appropriate to move us forward to this goal, and we're appreciative of the act that was passed last year. We also do standard setting in the multimedia area of our budget. And this one slide is meant to just show you how one standard that we are currently working on and preparing to promulgate later this year is going to work. We are in the process of setting a new phosphorus standard that will affect wastewater treatment plants across the state. And if you look at the pie chart, 75% of phosphorus emissions in the state come from non-point sources as opposed to point sources. But 25% comes from point sources. And we have a new rule that we are preparing again to promulgate later this year, which would reduce the amount of phosphorus emissions from point sources in about half. There are other rulemaking activities and standard setting activities that we do similar to this, but this is one of the most relevant and recent ones that we thought would be interesting to share. Environmental review is also funded out of the multimedia program. And environmental review, it's a very, very important activity. We operate this under the auspices of the Environmental Quality Board rules. We do quite a bit of environmental review. We typically do 30 environmental assessment worksheets a year. Many of those are ethanol projects and mining projects. We do one or two EISs a year, and those are paid for by the proposer. To a third-party contractor. We also review EAWs and EISs conducted by other units of government. I also wanted to talk to us a little bit about air emissions risk analysis. This is work that is done by scientists at the agency who help us assess the risks of new facilities, and it's a process that we've created to evaluate toxic emissions specifically from facilities that get permits from us. I think it's a meaningful step forward in evaluating risk from facilities compared to where we were maybe 10 years ago, and it does result in real results. We have a facility that was recently permitted, is in the process of being permitted by the agency that has changed its processes from the beginning of the process to where they are now entering into the permit process such that their toxic emissions are going to be half of what they would have been without going through this process. That's a fairly rigorous process that we use to keep a lid on toxic emissions in the state. Finally, very quickly, we have some training and certification programs which were funded out of this program. We train wastewater treatment plant operators. We provide some certification services to people who work in the septic system field, as well as training of landfill operators. The last thing I'll talk about is the administrative support program. Nothing terribly exciting here, but these are sort of the backbone, typical activities, administrative activities you'll find in just about any agency, with a notable exception for us of the Citizens Board. We are governed by a Citizens Board that does make decisions on most of the important matters that are brought before the agency in terms of permits and environmental reviews. Largely this comes out of special revenue and a little bit of general fund. Again, nothing too unusual there. The last thing is just some minor budgetary adjustments that I've talked about a little bit along the way. I mentioned in response to Senator Bach's question that we are seeking an increase in our appropriation for the air quality program along the lines of what the Clean Air Act and the statute requires us to do, and it would be $259,000 in the first year of the biennium and $526,000 in the second year of the biennium. And this increase is very similar to increases that we have sought in years past and is in conformance with Clean Air Act requirements. We also are proposing a small increase in funding to the Minnesota Department of Health to do environmental health monitoring, and this is an increase of $52,000 a year to the Department of Health, and this is so they can handle a lot of the increased workload that they are seeing as a result of things like the PFC contamination in the East Metro. We are also seeking authorization to increase funding to the water program. What this essentially means is we would transfer fewer dollars into the remediation program to keep it in the environmental fund to support the water program. This helps us continue to fund the historic gap in our ability to collect the revenue for support of the water program and makes the most use of the environmental fund. The last item is a compensation adjustment, which is a governor's initiative across the board in the general fund, and it's quite simply a 2% increase in compensation costs of $88,000 in fiscal year 08 and $177,000 in fiscal year 09. That concludes my presentation.
Well, we might have a couple questions about that last item, but I think we're out of time today. So maybe you could just let me know later or let the committee know if there will be any, any impact on remediation due to taking, it sounds like you're taking money out of remediation and shifting it. So,
Madam Chair, very briefly, these are program administrative costs. They're staff who conduct oversight of projects. In our estimation, based upon the projects we see coming before us, we can continue to do the work we need to do without those dollars.
So you don't anticipate it slowing down any projects, any results? Okay. All right, we're going to have to end. Thank you for going through this as quickly as possible. We really appreciate it. Members, on Thursday we have the LCCMR bill, we have the state parks and Senator Kugley's bill, and one other bill, I think. So it should be a pretty full agenda. Meeting is adjourned.
Good job. Yes. In case you want to take